All right, guys, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. We have Tony F. from Pass It On Home Group from Walnutport.
Thank you very much. Oh, there's a clock.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tony. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tony.
Ah, Lauren's on. Hi, Lauren. My sobriety date is November 18th, 2010. So I just celebrated 11 years. Thank you. My home group is passing it on. It's actually Berlinsville, but Walnutport's a little bit bigger than Berlinsville. The thing we meet every Sunday night at 6:30. Best home group for me. If you don't like your home group, you should find one that you do. And you know, I enjoy there. We have a lot of old timers, long timers, whatever you like. And I'm very active in recovery, and that's important. So I'm going to tell you what it was like for me when I grew up. And I don't think my story was that unusual than anyone else's. I grew up in a small town, a little town called Stiles, which was part of Whitehall. I was one of six children. I had three older brothers and two sisters, and I was the last of them. So if crap ran downhill, I got it. I had the same mom and dad. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. Prior to that, my dad was in the car industry, in the garment industry, rather. And he switched to Mack trucks in the 70s. And my dad worked hard. In my house, alcohol was not a bad word. We were German Catholic, and I don't even know if that means anything, but people always say that, like, you know, I was Irish Catholic. I don't know what people in India say, like, you know, ooh, I was Indian. You know, did they drink more because they were Indian in India? I don't know. But I'm not sure. I don't know that any denomination. If you got the disease of alcoholism, you're just alcoholic, you know, and that's it. I'm pretty sure alcoholism ran wild in my family. And I can pinpoint a lot of that as I go along. But again, alcohol was not a bad word in our household. You know, all my uncles, all my relatives had bars in their house. Alcohol was easily accessible. It was not uncommon to be a kid and go get a beer for your dad and crack it open and get a little off the top, or an uncle to say, hey, go get me a beer out of the refrigerator and take a little off the top. Hey, go get me that bottle. Go get me this. Go get me that. It just wasn't uncommon. If there was a party, there were barrels involved. If it was a christening or a birthday, a death, you know what I mean? There was alcohol everywhere, you know, and that's just the way I grew up around it. So, you know, by the time I reached the big year of 11, you know, alcohol was no stranger to me. And like I said, I had it a little bit when I was young, but I didn't really taste it till I was 11. And cause growing up, if you were to ask me when I was young what I wanted to be, you know, I grew up in a house with one TV. We had a radio, and I don't think it was to the 80s till I saw a second TV, and it was a 13-inch black and white. And the TV we had had a remote control, and I was it. I'm not kidding you. You know, I grew up with the 13 channels, and they weren't even 13 because it started at channel 2. But you watch what Dad watched, and we watched a lot of cop shows, and I wanted to be a cop because, you know, I wanted to be like Columbo, well, you know, long trench coat. You know, although he did drive a crappy car, but he did smoke a cigar, so I thought that was cool. But I never once said I wanted to be an alcoholic. You know, that was not in the cards. I never dreamed of that. By the time I reached 11, you know, when I was in school, I was a very uncomfortable person. I was about 6 foot already, and I grew up pretty big. I was pretty tall. I was one of the, me and there's another kid, we were pretty tall in our class. You know, I felt like a giant compared to some of the other kids. And I felt awkward and goofy and clumsy and all those things. And I could tell you, you know, after school, kids were smoking already at the age of 11, so I started smoking. And they were drinking on the weekends. And then I started to drink, and at the age of 11, when I took that drink, I felt very comfortable. I liked it immediately what alcohol did. the book talks about that sense of comfort and ease, and I relate to that today, like looking back. And, you know, if you said to me when I took it at the age of 11, if I could went back in time and said, well, hey, how did that make you feel? Well, I felt that sense of comfort and ease. No, I never said that or even thought that, but I felt comfortable. There's something that came over me when I took that drink, and I, you know, maybe I felt a part of, I felt like part of the crew, and maybe I was that sense of comfort and ease that actually Bill talks about in the book. I don't know if it was that warm feeling that came over me. I don't know if it was the warm feeling after it came up later that night, whatever. But there was something that happened after I took alcohol in my body for the very first time. And again, it wasn't the sipping off of my, from my dad's beers or my uncle's beers or that little bit of shot I might have did or the little taste of wine at church, you know. I don't think that had anything to do with me becoming eventually who I'm going to about to become. It was that feeling of not being who I was comfortable being in life. That alcohol was starting to fill that gap at that point, the minute I ingested it. And I think that's where alcohol started to lead the path to at this point. And again, this is a revelation of looking back on my life. So from this point on, you know, I don't think anything really bad happened right off the get-go. But I, you know, I started chasing that every weekend. We started becoming weekend warriors as kids because alcohol, like I said, it was easy to get. It was easy to take from parents' cabinets and under the kitchen sink. For some reason, I don't even know why you would put booze under the kitchen sink, but they did in our neighborhood. It was just like a weird spot. Even like to this day, I can't figure out why that is. But they did. People put booze under the kitchen sink, you know, because, God, I mean, if you did that today, think about it, there's Drano and stuff under there. That was a quick revelation there. I could see putting up with a vanilla extract and Listerine and stuff like that. But anyways, so they kept it under the sink and stuff like that. But we would grab bottles from each other's houses and stuff like that and go get drunk. And I remember one really bad drunk I had. It was drinking a fifth of Old Taylor, and I was about 14 years old. I drank a whole fifth of Old Taylor by myself. And I remember going to a carnival, and it was truly my first blackout. I don't remember anything. The next thing I know, I remember waking up with a garbage bag over my head, and I was laying on my mom's porch, because someone brought me home, I just don't remember who, and I was laying on the porch in my underwear, and this is like one of many fine quality moments for my parents, you know what I mean, for them to be proud of me, and at age of 14 already, so I mean, there are some signs here happening. And, you know, I'm laying with a garbage bag over there because I guess whoever brought me home didn't want me to throw up all over their car because the bag was, like, thinking I was just covered in puke. And, you know, my parents had to bring me in. I'll tell you what, I still remember that hangover. That hangover lasted for, like, 3-4 days because, like, I was going outside and it felt like the sun was melting me and shit. Like, I mean, like, you couldn't even, like, look at the sun. It was, like, it was hurting, you know. I don't even know what old, I looked that up. I think Old Taylor was like scotch or something. It was like rough. I never drank that again. You know what I mean? I learned from my mistakes, I thought. So, but, you know, going through high school was pretty good. You know, there was a lot of parties and stuff like that because, you know, once you start doing alcohol, you start doing other things. Speed was big when I was in high school in the 80s, Crossroads, Black Beauties and stuff. And I liked anything that was a performance enhancing drug. And I do talk about a little bit about drugs in my story because I never did a drug before I did alcohol. I had to be drinking for me to go get something. Like, I'm going to tell you right now, I hated pot. Like, I didn't like anything that brought me down. But I would be like drinking and I need something to keep me going because I'd be like drinking like, you know, after like about 10 hours, I was like, you know, kind of wearing down. I need something like, oh yeah, let me get going again. And, speed was a big part in the 80s for me. I had a bad episode with it, but I liked anything that could keep me going and keep me up for a couple days, you know what I mean, and keep partying, and speed was that, and there was a lot of stuff back in the 80s like that, and, you know, I didn't just use it, I was becoming a distributor while I was, you know, I was becoming an entrepreneur early on, and so... parties were great. You know, with alcohol, I was a romancer. I was a great singer. And I was a party machine. And life was good. I was invited to every party. I fit with everybody in high school. I mean, you name it. I fit with the Votechers because I went to Votech. I fit with the athletes, the preppy kids, whatever. So I was at every party. I just went everywhere because, you know, I had a pocket full of fun and, you know, I was ready to go. I always thought the party was wherever I was at. And that's how I believed life was. You know, looking back, it really wasn't like as glamorous as it looked. I think my glasses were a little bit fogged. You know what I mean? Yeah, like I said, you know what I mean? I think when you look back after some years, your perception really clears up a little bit of how things really were. Like, you like to think you're this person when you're out using and, you know, like I said, I thought I was this thing. I can't sing. I thought I was this great romancer. I don't think I was, you know, but I definitely could drink. You know what I mean? I definitely could hold my own. So, I was blessed with a great memory, and I think today I still am. You know, and I think that was, I truly think that was one of my gifts, that and numbers. I am great with numbers. And I do believe that is a God gift, God-given gift to me of my memory. And sometimes a memory can be a curse too at the same time, I think. But I never studied through high school. I had great grades. I was an honor roll student. But because I used to pay attention. That's all I did. Not because I was smart, but I used to just pay attention in class. And I could just do a test and boom, I was done. I mean, I was second in my class in electrical when I went to Votech. I could have been an electrician. I graduated with an electrical degree. But I chose not to because I was making more money cleaning floors. I really was. You know, I mean, when I left high school in the 80s, I was making 40 grand cleaning floors. I was a supervisor running one of the largest floor cleaning companies, at least in this area. I was cleaning over 300 Wawa food markets. I was running a strip crew for, in Pathmark, Lane Co's, ShopRites. We were pretty elite at that time. I was making good money, and plus I was getting paid cash on the table. I was working 108 hours a week, and I kind of put my drinking aside because I was working so many hours. But, I mean, I was padded. I mean, I had money. And but once that started to settle down, I met a girl who married one of my friends who was getting divorced, and we hooked up. And I should have seen this sign, but, you know. So, anyways, we hooked up, and she got pregnant, and we moved about. She got thrown out of her house by her mom, and we hooked up. And I had to get married to her. I didn't have to. I wanted to. I mean, let me rephrase that. That's probably bad. That made it sound worse than what it was. So we're going to have our first baby, and we get married because I need to get her on the insurance. Okay. Because babies are expensive, and that's still a fact today. And I get her on the insurance, and we get married in February 22nd. Of 96, and my son's born in July, so it was pretty quick. And so we have our first kid, and I'm still working like a dog. I mean, I'm working hard, working a lot of hours. So up to where we can buy a house. You know, we get another apartment, we buy a house, and we have our second kid. And things start to calm down now. I did it. I bought a house. I worked hard. She didn't have to work. I worked hard. And I gave her everything so she didn't have to work. And things were going good. You know, I started letting her take care of the monies and stuff like that. And we got our second kid, new house, new carpet. She had new cell phones, we had new cars. And things just seemed to be okay. My brother started a business. I started working for him. And, you know, I got around some people who were like me. And they went to go for a drink after work. Wow, a drink after work, that sounds like a good idea. And I did. And I liked it. And then they started going to drink after work every day. And I wasn't starting to come home. And she's there now with two kids. And we had our second kid. Well, you know, it's coming home later and later. You know, listen, it was just a scenario of things. This was destined to happen because I stopped working as hard. You know, I went from drinking heavy to not drinking heavy to working heavy. So I became from alcoholic to workaholic to back to drinking heavy again. And what happened was, I wasn't coming home at some points. And whatever happened in between there, whether it was me or the her or what, and again, this is not me pointing anything out, she found comfort in someone else at that point. Okay, and I didn't know it, and things got kind of mishap there. This was back in 2002, and we separated. It was March of 2002. She told me she was seeing someone else in my house with another guy. While my house was going into foreclosure, my car got repossessed, and I couldn't even afford gas, and I was making over six figures a year. I couldn't figure out where my money goes, and I couldn't figure it out to this day. And anyways, so she leaves. She says, we're going to get divorced. I'm hiring a lawyer, and I'm all like, I'm a rat, you know, poor me. And now I'm drinking, I'm smoking. I just quit smoking for 5 years. I'm back smoking like four packs. And we get divorced this whole summer, you know. I'm back to partying. I'm doing what I used to do. I'm drinking crazy every day. I'm driving around drunk with my kids, picking them up. You know, if I only had this, if I only had that, I'm crying the blues to everybody. And we finally get divorced. You know, I'm finally over it. It's October 31st, fully legally divorced. Fully legally divorced. I can't believe it's over. And I said to her, wow, we only have to do like this class on October, on November 7th. I said, and it's over. And we both can move on with our lives. So November 7th comes. We're getting ready to go to our class. We hook up, sleep together. A week later, we get remarried. And, you know, and she gets pregnant again. We have our third child. You know, that's living, right? Listen, I didn't punish myself enough the first time. So we spent 5 years in hell together. And it really was. We weren't happy, you know. Who knows? Who knows? And, you know, I tried controlling drinking during that time period, but maybe it was me. And you know how it is. When you start controlling what, and you're not happy, or if you can have the little, you're not happy, and you just, I was miserable, and I was angry, and I was turning, I was getting angrier, and I was miserable, and then I started pouring alcohol onto that misery, and it was magnifying. And so my anger, my depression, my frustration was magnified. There was no more joy left in my life. Okay, all that fun when I was having as a young man with all those parties and stuff. And you can imagine what was that fun like. I could have went into descriptions of all the parties I had. You know, listen, I danced naked on bars and stuff with my pants at my ankles. There was a lot of funny, comical stuff that happened. And I think a lot of us have had those moments. But the misery pain came at the end of my second marriage to my first wife. Because I tried to commit suicide. That's where depression took me. She wasn't happy. I wasn't happy. I was with someone. We both really weren't happy, but I was trying to make it work. And I was trying to force something. You can't force love. And that's just the truth. She wasn't happy. I wasn't happy. And, you know, I don't know what I wanted. I just know I didn't want to be there. And she didn't want to be there. I had kids, and she still was seeing another guy, and, you know, and I didn't even want, I don't know, and, you know, you could say cheating and this and that, and I was with a bottle, so who knows. You know, looking back, I cheated with a bottle, she cheated with a guy, but, you know, it's not a blame thing or nothing. So, but I did, I tried to commit suicide that night, and one thing led to another, the cops came, and I wrote a note, which I'm glad I got out of there, that note, and destroyed it. Because that would have really, did probably put me in a nut ward or something, I think. I know. But the good thing was my brother was home when the cops came, and he was a military guy, and he kind of like talked them out of them taking me, and I kind of talked myself out of them taking me. I said, I think she's just crazy. But what had happened was she ended up putting a PFA against me, and I wasn't allowed to go back into my house for a while. And, that kind of ended the marriage right there, which normally does. You know, kind of commit suicide around your saying you're going to commit suicide around your kids, that kind of like, you know, puts a kind of dimmer on any marriage. And, you know, So she didn't get the PFA that night, but the cops kind of suggested that she does. So for the next couple of days, I knew they were trying to serve me. And I knew I wanted to get some stuff out of the house. So I'm like parking up in the field and stuff. I'm like, I'm wearing like black clothes going down to my house. So I'm walking out with my TVs and stuff, like in two arms and stuff like this. And then the cops just show up and they're kind of like, yeah, you got to get out of here. But I'm walking out with all kinds of stuff. I said, I just bought this TV sheet. And, you know, like, this is how sick I was, you know. The neighbors are calling the cops on me. Because like, I did, I looked like I was robbing my own house. You know, if I could have walked out with the spy, I would have. But, you know, I was crazy. I had alcoholic sickness and thinking, and I was mentally unstable, to be honest with you. I was suffering depression, alcoholism, untreated alcoholism. Let's go with that. I was untreated for a lot of things. But I was going to fix that. How? I was going to move in with my brother, Jim, who is an active alcoholic. That's how I was going to fix it. So, I'm thrown out of my house, and I move in with my brother, and the party's on. Now, my brother drinks as much as I did, and it was glorious, because I was really suffering depression, and I was drinking while crying in my beer, and I mean, I was really in pain, and I was just drinking more and more, to the point I was really suffering. Inside, I was dying, I was falling apart. So, like, I was drinking to the point where I was just, like, passing out into things and falling over and stuff like that. So, I had needed something to enhance my experience. So, I turned to cocaine. So, I needed something to keep me, you know, mobile because, you know, at this point, I was just, like, crashing cars into ditches and stuff. It was weird. So, at work, I was working for my brother, and he hires this nice young girl. She was 15 years younger than me. Her name was Stephanie. And I took a nice liking to her. And I thought, wow, that's a nice girl. So she's sitting across from me, and I couldn't stop staring at her the whole time. She was, I just thought, wow, she's very nice. I just like the way she carries herself. So she gets hired, and we're talking day by day, and eventually we're getting to know each other. And she's a party girl, and she says, well, why don't you, we can text and stuff. So we start texting. Eventually we get to know each other, and she starts coming down to my house. We start hanging out. And what had happened was she likes to party. And she likes to party hard. She likes everything I like. She drinks like I do. The girl's like this tall. And, you know, 5 foot nothing. And I actually fall in love with this girl. But she works for my brother. And this is what puts the biggest rift between me and my brother. Who I'm working for, who I'm making over six figures for. And I know it. And this is actually what destroys my relationship with my brother. Because he told me not to date this girl. And I date this girl. And me and her party hard, and but I do. I actually fall in love with her, and the strain of the job and everything else puts a strain on our relationship, and we're off and on. She's leaving. We're fighting. We're arguing because of the job. We're sneaking around. And when you're sneaking around as adults, it's rough. I mean, man, we're grown people. We shouldn't have to do that. But there's so much sickness going on between us because she was suffering some stuff from her disease and I was suffering from my disease. So in 2009, we're kind of like separated. I'm going to speed up a little bit here so I can get to. So we're off and on, and this is taking us up to 2009. In October, we're separated for a little bit. She's with her dad now. Her dad raped her as a kid multiple times. So she was suffering that. So, you know, I was always tender with her because I did. I genuinely cared for this woman and, a lot. And I just couldn't see the stuff that she was going through. But she was away for a little bit and, in October, second week of October, I really had a revelation. I was really drinking too much. I'm not being serious. I really was having a revelation. Maybe I am just drinking too much. So I'm at a bar in, Seamsville Hotel off of Route 329. And I'm coming from there. I'm all lifted up and drunk. You know, I was doing like quite a few shots of tequila. I love tequila, by the way. There's some stories with that too. I'm leaving there and, I'm sitting at the corner of 329. 329 is a straight road. Seamville Road intersects. It's like a T. And I don't know what happened. It was, I remember it was like a little moist out. And instead of making a right, which I was to go home, I ended up going straight. But straight took me into a ditch, which I, it was weird because I would never go straight. So I ended up going straight into a ditch into the sign. And there's a brand new sign there, which I own. I paid for it. It's brand new. It's beautiful. I always go by it. I said, you see, I went right down the road. I always say, people, you see that sign? I bought that. It's new. It has a nice big arrow on it. It says Seamsville and Egypt and Northampton this way. It's cool. And I was like, one day I want to go get a little thing that said purchase by. But, you know, it says like, welcome to Lehigh Township, planned community, one of those little things. But, I pulled over to that ditch and my car wouldn't move out, but the ditch was pretty long, so my van sat across it. And I was trying to hit reverse and I just hear, whoo, and the van would back up. So I opened the door, step out. Well, there was no ground there. So what happened was it was a tree branch. I hit my head on that and then on a rock and I was knocked unconscious. And next thing I know, state troopers were pulling me out and into an ambulance. And the next thing I know, I woke up in a hospital with all my clothes cut off. I was laying there naked on a table, strapped down. And I'm letting this cop have it. I told him I'm getting his badge. You know what I mean? I'm mouthing off like I'm somebody. And the cop said, yep, you just stay there. You know what I mean? And he kind of let me know what was going to happen. You know, I'm strapped down. What was I going to do? Where was I going? Yeah. So he, you know, while I'm in that hospital there, my whole family knew I was in there. The only person that come to me was Stephanie. And I still remember that to this day. The only one. And, needless to say, I got a DUI. And that leads me into, like, things. So, well, at this point, I figure I do have a problem. So I go seek my brother who has some time in the program. And he says, well, maybe you should try AA out. You know, you used to take me to those meetings. I said, yeah, but I listened to those people. Those people are crazy. I said, all they talked about is their drinking problems. They were breaking into people's homes and stuff. I said, I don't do any of that. You know, and no, they were. Some of the people I heard, I said, like, wow, they are crazy. And I was thinking to myself, well, I said, all right. So I go to a meeting Monday night in Northampton, Give Time Time. They're my very first AA meeting for me. And I did. I actually heard a girl speak on, she was drinking about a fifth of vodka, and that girl was probably 4'11". I was thinking, my God. You know, but it wasn't that she drank the thing. That's the first thing I said. But then I was like, things that were happening to her, she was blacking out. Bad shit was happening. She was driving, crashing cars. I said, wow, that sounds familiar. And I thought, and then she talked about, she was doing these things and her life was getting better. And that kind of interested me. Like, what was she doing that was getting better? Well, you know, and I didn't hear, like, the steps. I didn't hear any of this yet. I heard, like, well, they were going to game night. They were hanging out at diners. I said, well, I could do some of that. I like to eat. And so I did that. I did that for quite a few months. I hung out with people in AA from October to June. I thought I had the first three steps down. You know what I mean? I knew I had a drinking problem. I knew God. I was going to church. And I, you know, I figured, well, his will should align with, we should align together at some point. And, that's all I was doing. I wasn't really doing anything, you know. I figured AA was going to work the way I wanted it to. And, that never really works out that way. You know. Me and Stephanie are off and on during this period. So June 8th comes, 2010. It's my birthday. I'm semi-sober. Semi. And my mom, my kids are at my house. I'm semi, again, I like that word. And I'm seeing my kids off and on. And my kids are there for my birthday. And I don't even know what sparked me. Oh, I do. Because I wasn't able to drive. Because my DUI finally came through. And I had ARD. And I only lost my license for 30 days. But the point was, I was just pissed off. I was just having a bad day. So I hop on a 10-speed bike, I drive up the street to Pizza Como, and I get 2 12-packs. I'm driving back on a bike, and I proceed to throw everybody out of my house, including my kids, and I start to drink. And I remember the faces of my kids, and I told them to get the F out of their house. You know, the snot, the tears. Something I'll never forget. I hurt them. Not only before that, I've hurt them. Pain you know, there's sometimes, I know I've done stuff in my addiction, and, you know, and I've made amends for some things, but I always think some of the amends, you know, people may forgive, but I don't know if they always forget. I think that. You know, I know Bill puts in there when he talks about the cheating part in the book, and I always laugh when you read it. It says, if we can forgive, so can she. I don't think that. Every time I read that, I laugh and I smirk at that part in that book because I don't believe that. Because I still think at some point people don't forget. And if you pick up a drink, they will be glad to remind you. Trust me. They'll be happy to and point out all your defects real quick again. So, just, you know, that's why sometimes when they say it's easier to stay sober than get drunk again, it is. Because you'll never have to relive those painful fingers pointing at you again saying, look, I told you so. And, so, anyways, so I go through June, July, and August with Stephanie, and in August we decide to get married on her birthday, August 27th, 2010. We get married. And we're still partying. I'm going in and out of meetings. I'm going to meetings. I'm leaving there. I'm drinking. The last 3 weeks of November, and these are my favorite to talk about. I was drinking about 230 packs a day. I picked 130 pack up when I left work in Stroudsburg on Main Street, which was exactly 1 mile down the street from where I worked. In 33 miles, I would drink 18 of them. When I got home, I would shower. I would finish the rest off. I would go pick up another 30 pack. I would finish those off before the night was through. I'd pick up a fifth of tequila, an 8-ball of Coke, and I would finish that before the night was through. And that was a daily thing for the first 3 weeks of November. Till November 17th, where I finally collapsed. Because I wasn't sleeping. And I was doing that on a daily basis. On November 17th, I finally collapsed. I stayed in that room for 3-4 days. My wife Stephanie says I was having psychotic episodes. I was talking to people that were deceased or not there. I don't remember any of it. And maybe I'm not supposed to. She said I talked to my father. My father was dead at that point about 15 years. He died in 2000, April 5th, 2000. I don't remember anything of that. I remember coming out of that and on that Monday, my brother said I should come see him in his office. And he said, brother, you need some real help. I remember those words. And I went to rehab up at Marwood. And I spent about 17 days there. I spent Thanksgiving through there. Which, by the way, if you're ever in a rehab at Thanksgiving, they really do treat you pretty good with the food. Just throwing that out there. We had nice turkey and stuff. Yeah, it was good. But my wife came up and they let us spend Thanksgiving together. That was kind of nice. But while I was in rehab, not one family member called me. Nobody, other than my sponsor. My sponsor and my wife. My sponsor at the time, Harry, when I was going up there, he said, just listen to what they say in rehab and do what they do. When I was in rehab, I learned about the disease of alcoholism that, in the doctor's opinion, they talk about, that sickness, that why when I consume alcohol, it affects me differently. And that's something I needed to understand, that I don't take it the same way another person does. And one of my last nights there, we had a big meeting in that big room there. There was about, you know, 300 people there. But I was one of 125 patients. And they said, you know, only one or two of you are going to get it. And I really wanted to be that one. You know, I did. And Harry came up with about five guys from the Allentown area. And I thought, wow, that's weird that these guys have nothing better to do on a Saturday night but then come up and see me. I still find that weird to this day. But they came up to see me. And that was cool. And, you know, they said, leave there and make a meeting the first day. So when I left that meeting, it was a Wednesday. I met Harry at a meeting in Fullerton. It was an 8 p.m. meeting. And I went to that meeting. And when I got out of that meeting, Harry said to me, he said, Tony, I want you to go home and I want you to write why you think you're an alcoholic. I thought, man, the nerve of this guy making me go home right while he thinks I'm an alcoholic. So I'm in rehab, knew I had a DUI, and I'm sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Yeah. He said, well, first of all, he wants to, you know, I did go write the list, and the following week I get the list done, and I'm all proud, like I did some homework. You know, full adult doing homework, you know what I mean? A 40-year-old man, I'm out of school how many years? Graduated in 88, and I'm 40 years old now. And I've given this list, this paper, and he goes, Tony, I don't need to see that. He goes, I kind of knew you were alcoholic, but you needed to know. Because one, I wanted to make sure you weren't some lonely bum just hanging out at the ruins of Alcoholics Anonymous because you were lonely. But you needed to know that you were alcoholic. That you would identify yourself as an alcoholic when you hear another speaker that you're identifying and not comparing. And that nothing, absolutely nothing is going to take you out of this room ever again. And that was powerful. And he goes, that's step one. He goes, because when you wrote that, you identified as an alcoholic and you've seen your unmanageability. And I did. I seen where my unmanageability was. I wasn't in part of anybody's life but my own. That's the power of self. I was in my own life and nobody else's. So, when I got to step two with my sponsor, he made me do a list on a piece of paper what I thought God was and what I wanted God to be. What I thought God was obviously the God of the Old Testament, destructive, you know, the plagues, you know what I mean? I was going to bathe in a pool of blood or something. And what I wanted God to be was all-powerful, caring, loving, a father, because I didn't have one, you know, and take care of me. And we went to the Priscilla Payne Herd building in Bethlehem, where we used to do the Big Book Workshop, one of Rhubarb Jim's places. And we knelt down there at the chapel. And before we did that, he said, you don't think God could be all of those things? He said, why can't he be? And I said, why not? And together we took the third step prayer. Now we looked at, there was a couple things we looked at in the third step. And the first thing we had to look at is, I had to quit playing God. I couldn't control all situations anymore. And in the third step prayer, we asked to be removed of the bondage of self. And the one thing I always liked about the third step is this is the beginning of the end of self. It's the beginning. It's not the full end of it, but it's the beginning. It's where I stop looking at myself and start thinking a little bit about other people. Because it's showing what my higher power is going to do through me so I could show other people of what my higher power is doing through me. And at this stage of the game, in my early sobriety, he's removing the obsession to drink from me. That's all that's happening here in the third step. He's not giving me my children back. He's not giving me life. He's not giving me the winning lottery ticket that I'm not playing, because I'm praying for to win the lottery, but I'm not playing the lottery. And he's not giving me anything else. He didn't give me a brand new car, although you people keep saying that people get brand new cars in AA, and I keep thinking that's what the collection plate's for. But all he's doing is removing the obsession to drink in the third step. And that's what had happened. So once I took the third step prayer with my sponsor and another man, we knelt down, took the third step prayer together, and we prayed it out loud. And then they prayed for me. They prayed for me that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me. And that was the first time I knelt down with two other men, and they prayed for me. And I thought that was the coolest thing. I prayed with a bunch of people, being Catholic. And but we never prayed. I never had someone pray for me. In a group setting. I thought that was just one of the coolest things. It was very spiritual and it gives me chills right now. The fourth step was pretty easy because it was all about me. My favorite person to talk about. So, but in the fourth step, you know, first I looked at my good qualities because I did have a few. You know, like I said, I'm hardworking. I do care about other people most of the time. As long as it used to involve me, because most of my life, I was running through life like a Hoover Deluxe. I was sucking everybody dry. So in the fourth step, after I looked at my good qualities, I had to look at all the people I disliked and why I disliked them. And that's how my list started. But I had to look at why I disliked these people and what my part was in them. And I always love the line in the Big Book. It says, we stepped on the toes of our fellows and they retaliated. Well, I never realized I was hurting these people and they were just getting back. I caused pain in a lot of people's lives because of how I acted and what I was doing because of my alcoholism. You know, alcoholism, affects more people than I thought it did. It affected more than just me. You know, if you, when I first got here, if you would ask me, did I affect anybody with my disease? Well, I only thought it affected just my immediate family, my wives, and my children. But there were so many people that it did affect. It affected my employer, people I worked with. It affected my children, my mom, my brothers, my sisters. Because there were people worrying about me. There were people either checking morgues or hospitals and thinking I was dead. I mean, my final year of drinking, I smashed 11 cars. You know, there's a good possibility I could have been dead, or I could have killed somebody. You know, by the grace of God, I did not. You know, so I wrote my fourth step. I wrote my fears and resentments. I obviously had a lot of fear, like a lot of us. And I wrote my sexual misconduct. Well, I didn't write my sexual misconduct. That's a lie. My sponsor told me not to write it because I was married at the time. And, you know, I don't tell my guys to write that. We talk about them, though. We do take hostages. But what I did learn in my sexual misconducts is I didn't know how to have a relationship with anybody, even myself. So one of my best relationships that I started out with in this program was my relationship with my higher power and myself. And once I was able to learn how to have that relationship, I was able to have relationships with other people, even my pets. I didn't have relationships with them. But it's amazing. I have relationships with everybody now. You know, I have pretty good relationships with a lot of people, and that's a blessing. That is a blessing. 6 and 7. I wish I would have known today about 6 and 7 what I knew then. 6 and 7, you know, and they say you could do 6 and 7 in the same breath. I don't believe that, and I don't believe that today. 6 and 7, there is definitely some work in 6 and 7. 6 and 7 is more than just taking, saying, God, remove these defects of characters and shortcomings and just identifying them. This is a lifelong process. It's the deadly sins broken down, and there's a lot in them. At the time I did them, I had a list of character defects of 68. I thought I only had 67. To find out, I really did have sloth. I didn't think I was lazy. But there's, you know, well, who knew sloth was like, you know, if you go help somebody to put off something you're doing, that's sloth. Who knew that? I just figured that out a month ago. I didn't know that. That's being lazy. Not doing your own work to go help somebody else. There you go. I had sloth. So, I wish I would have took a little bit more time, but with my guys today, I spend a little bit more time on 6 and 7. You know, I've been doing heavy studies with that Drop the Rock. I'm going to be telling you, and that's been powerful for me. I read that about a year and a half ago on the beach. It changed my life. It told me to go deeper and to let go of things and to work on myself a little bit stronger. And it was a life-changing event for me. Absolutely life-changing. 8 was just a list. That's all it was. It was a list for my 4th step. I put some people on there that weren't, and that were my children. My amends went well. The list I sometimes add, there's some people I never got to. There's some people I'm not supposed to. Because there's some nevers, and it's usually the women. And, you know, I always say, you know, there's a few that women that got on without me, and I'm still shocked that they have. And I said I was a great guy. All drunk, passed out, you know, wet pants, bag over my head, laying in puke. Yeah, what a catch. Quality. 10 is a lesson I've learned. 10 is a lesson I learned from my 4 and 5. I learned how to identify the problem. And 8 and 9, how to make that right. Well, I love my step 11. It's the most beautiful. I think step 11 is the most beautiful step we do. It's all through prayer and meditation to increase our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. So what that looks like for me is I reflect on my day at night. I ask God if did I do anything right today or did I do anything wrong. And sometimes maybe I just didn't drink and maybe I just, you know, some days I have a bad day. But, you know, I pray throughout the day, you know, and just remember, prayers are not just for breakfast. And my morning starts off with 3rd step, 7th step. I do Psalm 23. I do a prayer to St. Michael. I pray for all the people in my life. I do I do a biblical reading for me, you know, and this is something that I've grown on. And then I do some church passages. You know, I do an Old Testament and a New Testament. Because at one time I used to read the Daily Reflections, 24-hour a day, Emmett Fox, and things. And you know what? By the time I got to my car, you know what I remembered? Nothing. Because I tried to cram all this A literature in my head at one time, and I couldn't remember anything. So I started taking things in piecemeal and tried to slow it down a little bit and take something from it. Because you people have told me I should take what I need and leave the rest, you know. So I try to take a little bit. And then when something gets stale, I switch it up. Because for the first year, I probably read Daily Reflections. Then I read the 24-hour a day for a year. And then I read something else. And then I read something else. Because Bill said, see where other people are right. Continue to grow. Continue to grow. And I always try to continue to grow. Today I have a sponsor that I've always had. But I took on a spiritual sponsor because I need to grow somewhere else. And he's in AA. He has a lot of years, but we do other things together on a Sunday. And that's where my life has taken me. So in AA, a lot has happened over the last 11 years. Let's see. In 2015, Stephanie passed away on March 20th, 2015. She died directly from this disease. She had a lung disease called sarcoidosis, but she tried to compensate it because the pain was getting grave for her. We went to bed on March 19th, 2020. And I reached for her in the morning. I woke up before my alarm. It was weird. And I reached over to her, and she was really cold, so I tried to cover her. I put on the light. I said, wow, she's really cold. She was blue. I called the ambulance, I called her mom, I called my mom, and I called my sponsor. My sponsor spent the day with me. For the next 2 weeks, my sponsor didn't leave me alone. He shadowed me for 2 weeks. I'll never forget that. That Wednesday, the day of the funeral, I had her mom up. We cleaned out the house. I let them take everything of hers. And I couldn't make a meeting that day. And that night at the funeral, I mean, I remember still walking in there and seeing her urn there, and I almost collapsed. I just remember that my sponsor was there. He stayed, you know. And I only had 30 family members there, but I had over 300 people from Alcoholics Anonymous there, and that was so cool. The one time I couldn't get to a meeting, AA came to me, you know, and that was powerful. It was absolutely powerful. You know, people were bringing me food. They were showing up at my house, even when I didn't want them. AA has done a lot for me. I met another woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who's my current wife. Her name's Trina. We met in AA. She has 14 years of sobriety. We celebrate together. We celebrated last night. One thing I like about Trina is she's very independent. She's very pig-headed, and she's an alcoholic. And one of the hardest places to work this program is in my own home. I've always said that. There's nothing worse than two alcoholics who are right. But we meet somewhere in the middle. But we just celebrated our 5-year anniversary when we went to Gettysburg together. But, you know, we meet on common ground. She has a higher power. I have a higher power. She works a program. I work a program. We go to one meeting a week together, and she does what she does. To me, service is one of the most important things. You know, we were just talking before. That's one thing I loved about Rich. I like to mention him. I got close to Rich a little bit. I didn't know him like a lot of you did, but I did get to know Rich through service. That's how I got to know Rich, and that's how I get to know a lot of people is through service. People in service that I'm very attracted to, because I think service is the most important thing we do is when we put, you know, we always talk about that hand of AA, and the only way that hand of AA gets out there is through service. If we're not in facilities and we're not doing step work and we're not greeting at the door and we're not standing up here chairing a meeting and we're not making coffee, what are we doing? All we're doing is showing up at meetings. Or we're not reaching out to five alcoholics a day, or whatever. Service is the most important thing we do, and Bill Wilson knew that when he wrote this book, because if we're not constantly working these steps, we're dying. We're dying inside. I got to be constantly working this. I don't have to do all these steps for myself all the time. I work these 12 steps every day of my life. There's no, so to me, I cringe when someone says, well, I just do the maintenance steps. There's no maintenance steps. I have to do step one every day. It tells me that right in the beginning. I have to do that 100%. I work all 12 steps every day. That's the design for living that this book talks about. I got to work 1 through 12. Okay. I have to work 1 through 12. And how do I work 1 through 12? Well, I take on a new person, and we start at step 1. And we go 1 through 12. And I constantly look for a newcomer to work the steps with. And you know what? Do I have sponsees? Yes. Do I work the program with them? Yes. And if they stick around, then they stay. If they want to move on, they move on. But we get through the program. And I learned that from Rhubarb. But, you know, AA has been more my family than my own family. I could testify to that. This has been the best thing that ever happened to me. And I said early on, I took that first drink to be part of something. Who knew I had to become an alcoholic to be a part of something great? You know what I mean? So, like I said, I took it right up. I always read something before I finish because I don't ever like to ruin what Bill Wilson wrote. And it's, this is what the problem of getting old. The eyes are starting to fail. I'm part diabetic too, so my eyes, I've been trying to get an eye doctor appointment. It's been crazy. This is from chapter 7. Life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover. To see them help others. To watch loneliness vanish. To see a fellowship grow up about you. To have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. That's my program. I have a fellowship about me. I have a host of friends, and I am in contact with newcomers all the time, and it is an experience. It's the best experience of my life, and my best day is yet to come. I just want to be sober when it gets here, so thanks for letting me share.